Or Lou had to be submitted 3 or 4 times.
So if we were to test for you after this class, are you able to tell us?
Maybe. I'm sure it'll be on the computer probably.
Yeah.
It's, I had a letter grade, I think, that took a while there as I gave a letter grade.
Oh, and then
they told me that you don't have letter grades?
Yeah.
So I converted letter grade to number. But that took 3 or 4 iterations with the person involved, so I hate what it was.
So everybody has got, there are like 4 different grades, people got it one of them?
It's basically, you got a letter grade, you all got the same number grade because it was the same letter grade.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you. But you know, it should be enough, right? And then the Western grades weren't just enough we submitted, so I have one, but I haven't sent it to the person. So now your assignment for us, those that are permission, should you choose to accept it?
Yeah.
This is more calculational in the sense of, you know, computing rates and cross sections and things like that. And someone was saying that I should have, the motivation for the various examples of things you looked at in the previous assignment were not random. So the, and the, most of them come from supersymmetry, so that when you're looking at adjoint fermions, or you're looking at colored scalars, or you're looking at two Higgses, those things are typically things that you get as supermarkers. So that's why those examples were ones you want to know.
Is this one going to be due midterm, or?
What's that?
Is this one going to be due midterm?
We're thinking at the end of February. Oh. And I'd imagine there'll be an negotiation process that happens then.
Is there what?
I imagine there would be a negotiation process that happens then.
So there is going to be an assignment 3 as well then?
Could be. It depends on how far we get a little bit. And so that's kind of why I figured I'd stop here. This is kind of the, you want to get this far, otherwise you're disappointed in what you learn.
Yeah.
But this kind of gets us up to chapter 7, and there's lots of other questions. That's right. So remember where we were last time? Last time we calculated the K rate for this boson to go to 2 fermions.
It's pretty odd.
We didn't do this, but we could have done this. We did this for the assumption that the Z boson was unpolarized, which is to say that we had an equal number of all possible polarizations. And then we summed over all possible things the fermion could have done. And let me just write down what the answer was. We had a cross section, which was for a rate. We found the K rate for this to be. The thing I actually talked about in class, I think, was where we neglected the fermion mass divided by the Z mass. So if the fermion mass was essentially zero, this is became, you know, GV squared. There's a factor which I didn't write at the time, but which I should have written, and that is, so this, as stands, is true if, for fermions, you think of that as being an electron, say. But if it's a quark, then this is the right result for a red quark. Because quarks have three colors, and we haven't summed, we've summed over all the spins, but we haven't summed over any of the other labels of the particles. So if you really want the rate to go into an up quark without specifying which color of up quark, there's an overall factor of three that would have to be here. So traditionally you write that as NC, where NC, so this is, let me finish this line here. In the limit, this is negligible, this is what this becomes. And NC here is one for quarks, that being a quark, three, and one for that equals leptons. And I kind of, these G's are given in terms of the various charges. So I might as well write that down for you, just to remind you. If the GV was 1/2 C3, that's Q sine squared by W, the P axial. That's the third component of us just being for the various terms at the time. And I missed the dimensional thing here. The mass of the Z. This is dimension 1 over time. So if H bar and C is 1, then this has the dimension of the mass. So the whole thing has to be a mass. The energy that was available in the decay was mz, so the dimension you'd expect to be portion of mz. The fact that this is small says that the width is smaller than the mass, which is to say that it's long-lived compared to a generic particle. The fact that this factor goes to zero when mz is equal to 4 mf squared is the thing that says that if 4 mf squared had been larger, if you dial mf from zero up until it's 1/2 mz, then this makes the rate smaller and smaller and smaller until it hits zero when the fermions are half a z mass. And that's because energy conservation forbids the decay once you're more expensive, more acid than that. In numbers, this turns out, if you just plug in the numbers for all these masses and couplings, the total width, so you sum over all the fermions, that turns out to be 2.44 GeV. Just plugging in all these numbers and then compares to the experimental number, which I give in the next here, which is 2.4952 plus or minus 0.23. Let's see. So you see that you're getting this is a lowest order perturbation theory approximation, and it's doing very well in the agreement. It's not doing perfectly well because the error here is in the, you know, in that digit, and we're differing by 5 in that digit. And that difference is something which you can see if you look at the rate of diffractions. So beyond leading order to sub-dominant contributions make up that difference. In terms of a time, that becomes, so 1 over gamma is the lifetime, that's the mean length. And that's, if you put in the numbers, that's something like 1.7×10^-25. Remember it? No, 2.7. So it also tells you something. It says that, you know, if it's moving at the speed of light, you know, 10^-25 seconds, you go 10^-17 meters. So you don't go very far. Yeah?
Is T, how's T related to G?
How's what?
TA. You define GV and then you define TA.
Oh, that's GA, sorry. It's American metric. Go nuts. So that says that if you're in business looking for these things, you produce a Zen particle in your detector, it'll go, you know, it won't go exactly 10 to minus 17 meters for decays, because the same argument, if I made the same argument for, you'll see that around the muons, their lifetime is 10 to minus 6 seconds, so it's like almost a microsecond. And in a microsecond, you would have thought that a muon could go, you know, 10 to the 2 meters. So you wouldn't expect muons to go farther than 100 meters if they only live for a microsecond. But we're being bombarded by muons all the time that are being produced at the top of the atmosphere, because cosmic rays hit the top of the atmosphere, they interact with nuclei, and they produce muons. And those muons pass through us, and they've gone more than 100 meters to get from the top of the atmosphere to us. And they do that because, in their frame, they're living for 10 minus 6 seconds, but they're relativistic, so that they're in our frame, they're living longer because of time dilation. And so what I'm telling you about these things only going 10 to minus 17 seconds is not exactly right, because the life, this is the mean life in the rest of it. And you remember, we had to make that choice in deriving this. At some point, we chose the four momentum of the Z boson to be mass 0, 0, 0, so we can put ourselves in the rest frame. In a general frame, the lifetime is going to be longer, so it's going to be the rest frame times the energy divided by the mass. Because that's the relativistic time dilation factor. And so if you really want to know how far it's going to go, then you want to know what the energy of the Z boson was in your frame. But it's not going to be, if this is telling you that things will go 10 to minus 17 meters, then any of the accelerators that are being produced now, this factor is 1,000. Okay? It's not really going to be giving you a macroscopically large system.
But is this the only way that the Z can decay into two forms?
No, this is the only way that leading order pervasive theory.
How do you manage to run it?
Remember, the logic was that we knew that the rate was proportional to the S matrix element squared, and the S matrix was 1 minus, you know, I integral of V d tau plus minus I squared over 2 integral. So the lead is we stopped here because each of these V's carried with it a factor of a small number like this. And so if we stopped here, then we can only decay it to impermanence. But if you include stuff like this, then there's more complicated things that can happen. But they're going to happen less, that would be a small fraction of the case because it's lower, higher order degree. So if you look at the fraction, that was one of the things that the fraction of times that it goes into, say, electrons, is, I find that last time. So the fraction into a particular fermion is defined to be the rate for Z to go to that fermion divided by the rate for Z to go to fermion. And that's determined in that ratio, factors of the mass and a coupling dropout, and it only depends on things like these coefficients. And if you look at the fractions that you get, there's a table in the book. I'm going to write it down. So if you look at any of the neutrinos, we mu tau, you plug in from that formula, you get 20.5%, and the measured value here is 20 minus 6, let's say 20%. You do for electrons, muons, taus, bottom quarks, then other quarks, so U, C bar, doesn't happen actually. And these three should all be the same because they all share the same couplings, and so you would have predicted that this could have been 3.45%. The difference will not all be in the mass of leading order, so that if they're going to differ, they'll differ from that, or from the subleading contributions in perturbation theory. And so the measured values are not exactly the same. Six, 3.36, 3.270, And the error is kind of 8 in this place. And for bottom quarks, you can identify those because you can identify that one of the hadrons that decays into. It should have been 15%. 15.18%, and that's measured to be 15.14. And this is, the rest of it is about 54%. That's 54, measured to be 54.76. So the thing is that this leading order does a great job of telling you which fraction of time it decays into various things. And everything you're missing by those higher order things is 100 minus those, which is some small fraction, which is what you expect given that it's this thing where it is.
So, like, I understand the fact that there are higher order terms that are contributing, but how, like, for example, in the neutrino, the decaying into neutrinos,
yep.
Like, the calculated value is higher than the measured value.
Yep.
And so how is perturbation theory going to subtract this?
You know the sign, the amplitude is, you're squaring an amplitude, and the amplitude doesn't have to grow. It can shrink, right?
So that's to say that there are higher order effects that are canceling the first order effects.
Yeah, you don't know the sign of the higher order effects.
But still, physically, doesn't that mean that there are cancellations that happen with the original, like, the first order effects?
Yeah.
So, okay, that doesn't make much sense. That's kind of...
Why?
Not intuitive. Well, just from a process of...
You're thinking that if I have m squared, it has to be positive, and I add to another thing, it's positive. Another square, it has to be positive.
Well, just from a decay point of view. Right, higher order effects mean that they're intermediate particles or something, right? Or,
yeah.
So, like, how are these higher effects going to eliminate the first, like, it's going to, how do you get negative probability?
So when I square this, you know, I get a big term, which is that squared, then I get cross term, which is definitely fine.
Okay.
It's a percentage. You lose percentage because the number on the bottom gets bigger faster than the number on the top.
That could also be true, but even if that didn't happen, there's nothing that says that sign has to be up. Fractions don't have to make the rates bigger.
Yeah, but those aren't rates, those are percentages.
Right.
So all that happens is when you add in more terms, say the reason that some will go up and some will go down is as a percentage, if it doesn't grow as fast as the total grows, so as if other things grow faster than neutrinos, it'll push the percentage for neutrinos down.
Yeah.
That could happen, but it doesn't have to happen that way. That may be actually what happened in this case. I don't know. Off the top of my head, I can't remember what the biggest correction is. The biggest correction typically is the strongly interacting part. You're probably right, actually, because the strongly interacting thing is the one that has the biggest corrections. Because your intuition for how big corrections should be is, you know, each factor of a coupling between a Z boson and something like a fermion is costing you E divided by things. Whereas if you couple to a gluon, or a quark to a gluon, that gives you a strong coupling rather than E. And then once you put in two pi's and things from the, you know, you square that to get a rate, you know, we didn't get E, we got E squared here. So typically a rated correction is actually measured by E squared. If you define alpha to be E squared over 4 pi, and alpha 3 to be G3 squared over 4 pi, then typically the corrections are of the order of alpha for 4 pi. That's what more gives you a better idea of what the correction should be. And so whereas alpha here is, this is already 10 to minus 2 or something, this is point, it depends on where you evaluate it, but it's bigger. And so the corrections, if you take, this is being, the actual value at the z equal, I've forgotten what it is, but the worst case scenario, say it's 0.1, then this is something which is again 10 to minus 2, so you're talking about a percentage change in things, but the thing that will change the most will be things involving the hadrons, which would be these guys. So then it's plausible that if that went up, that would be the main thing, because neutrinos don't do a lot, so that they don't get a lot of corrections. So the biggest correction to the percentage would probably be the total grades, roughly right. And the correction is probably, it's about the right size, right? I didn't tell you the decimal points there, but I didn't tell myself the decimal points there. At some point, you have to worry about you're not literally, so this, an objection you could have had is that, so this is really the rate for producing an up quark and an anti-up quark, but you don't actually produce those. What you see is pions or some sort of a bound state of those things coming out of your detector. And so there's a step that I should have to make to justify using this, comparing this number, which is a quark number, to this number, which is a seeing hadrons come up number. And the argument there is actually, there are some things that you can't calculate very well in perturbation theory for the strong interactions. For example, if I wanted to calculate the rate for, you know, CC bar pairs or for specific kind of a final hadron to be produced, that's difficult to do because you need to know the wave function of the hadron, and there's a whole bunch of things that go into that. But as long as I'm summing over all possible hadrons, that's what allows you to make calculations like this so simple, because what you're more or less doing is you're calculating a rate which is proportional to the sum over all the final states, not exactly. I have some amplitude, you know. I want to use that, but I'll use curly F. So we're calculating something like this, summed over the final states. And one way to think about this is that if I wrote this as being, you know, I, S, dagger, F, F, S, I, summed over F. You're going to see that what I have, the sum over F part of it is really just this, and it's a partition of unity in the space of hadrons. So the thing is that what we calculated here was a sum over a particular basis of hadrons, summing over all the quark states, and those are not anywhere near the energy eigenstates. In the strongly interacting sector, the energy eigenstates are the hadrons you see. You have protons and neutrons and pions and final states of quarks. They're not quarks. But if I'm summing over a basis, for a partition of unity, it doesn't make a difference what basis I use. It's the same answer. So it's convenient for the calculation to sum over basis and quarks, even though those are not energy eigenstates, as long as I do the whole sum. And so that's why the sum of these quark rates is agreeing quite well with the measured hadronic rate, which would have corresponded to doing the same thing when we're... So the calculation is doing this where F equals quark, but the experiment is doing this with F equals the physical hadron that's been measured. And the answer is the same because it's just the basis. You don't care if the basis is doing the sum. And so the message is that if you're calculating inclusive processes, are defined by summing over all final hadrons. Or all finals. Typically, it's the hadron to use for, because that's what you don't calculate very well. And these processes are the ones that you can calculate in perturbation theory because you're relying on an argument like this to say that the quark rate is the same as the answer. These are easy to calculate in perturbation theory. But if you want to do the same thing for, you know, a pion, z goes to pi plus pi minus, that's really hard to calculate perturbation theory because you're making a restricted sum here, and then you need to know how the basis of quarks relates to the basis of hadrons, which you don't unless you know the wave function of those pions. What else I want to say about that?
How are you able to isolate the VD bar then?
So the exception to this rule will be if I summed over all possible things consistent with a charge. So let's say I wanted to sum over all things that were that all states that had variable number one or something. Then it's equally well, instead of having that thing is the projection operator onto all the space of hadrons, right? But if I could have had a projection operator onto a subspace of hadrons which has a definite conserved charge, like variable number, and then the same argument would work. As long as I'm defining my states to be labeled by something conserved charge. And it happens that bottomness is, from the point of view of the strong interaction, it's pretty much conserved because the bottom quark actually lives for quite a long time. You can actually see it move before it decays. And so that means that experimentally they can actually identify, they can tag whether or not there was a D quark that decayed in the thicker zen. So they can actually identify experimentally a subset of the hadronic interaction which corresponds theoretically to a sum over things that are labeled by conserved charge, and you can make the same argument. But you always have to make the case that you can make this argument when you're trying to talk about a specific hadronic final state of that. That's why they didn't do this on here, that they don't have a similar argument for the other quarks. Something else I wanted to say here. One thing that I'm going to say later on, I guess, that oh, there's two things. Here, I told you this is the size of the corrections, and there's an exception to that. These corrections are actually a little bit too small to count for some of these differences. Because if you're looking for a percent error, that would be like 3 in this decimal point, right? And we're already disagreeing on more than that, so you can know two things. And that's because there are some corrections which are bigger than these, and they tend to be involving logarithms that are large. So you get things like alpha from 4 times, 5 times logarithm of mz squared divided by me squared or something like that. So those logarithms can be big. You know, this is a half an MeV, and this is almost 100 GeV. That logarithm becomes big enough that it can convert 10 to the minus 2 to something which is like make it 5 times bigger. And so that can be the difference between a percent effect and a 7% effect, which is the kind of things that you're seeing in the errors here. So it's worth your while to identify where logarithms come in that are large. And so down the road, we're going to do that. And the good news is that they don't come in a lot of places. So that once you can identify where a logarithm comes in that's large, for the actual nitty-gritty of identifying the dominant contribution in perturbation theory, you can sometimes do better than just leading order perturbation theory. You can the largest subleading contributions in perturbation theory are often identifiable without doing the whole subleading calculation because the logarithms could be picked out more easily. Then the last thing I want to say about this was, the statement that the width is small compared to the mass. If you don't see anything decay, what does that mean? So this is much less than the z mass because of these small factors, and those small factors are small because we're doing perturbation theory, or that was what justified doing perturbation theory. So if things are decaying in a perturbative way, we're expecting them to have a width which is small compared to its mass. The way that you actually will see that in practice will be, since you don't actually see the z particle you produce, what people actually do is they glide, you know, e plus e minus, and that produces a z, and then that produces the thing you're going to look at, say a fermion and antifermion. And what people do is if you look at the cross section for this process, e plus e minus goes to z, or goes to f bar, that as a function of energy. The center of mass energy, let's say, this cross section, it does something like it starts off actually very large, goes down, then it has a big resonance. It's more like that. It's kind of not a symmetric thing so much. Boy, that's a dog's breakfast. The leading order would have done something very symmetric, but then there's actually one of these logarithm things which is interesting large. And the width of this thing is essentially given by, that's what's called width. This quantity, which is 1 over mean length, is what controls the width of this resonance. And I'll come back to that when we talk about cross sections. So that's kind of, in practice, how you can measure the total. You might have asked, how do you measure things like the decay rate of neutrinos? Because the neutrino is something which it doesn't decay, it doesn't interact with anything, and so that's like, that's a collision which produces nothing. And so how do you measure how often the Z goes into nothing? There's two ways to do that. One is to measure this total width, because that's telling you the total rate for the Z to go into anything, regardless of whether you saw it. Because you can measure this by looking at, we can choose this to be electrons or muons. So choose a definite final state, calculate this, measure this cross section, and this width is going to be controlled by the rate for z to go to all. Another way, so that's how it was first done, but another way of doing it to really be sure that you're getting it right is you can look for one of the very rare processes that you're talking about. You can have z goes to e plus, it goes to nu bar, but then it could have been that before that happened, the electron radiated off a photon or something. And then you can look for the photon. And then that rate is related to the rate without the photon in a way you understand. And so by looking for processes where z e plus e minus goes to photon, you can figure out what the rate would have been without the photon and compare that to what you get or something like that, then it all works. It's why people believe that they can tell you what the invisible width of the Z is. And the last thing I wanted to say was, this is the total rate. And if we had calculated, I did it for a sum over all final spins, and I averaged over the initial spins, because that was supposed to represent a sample of Zs which were polarized in all possible ways with equal numbers. But we could have done the same thing where if we took a specific polarization of the Z and asked for it to decay, and we would have got the same answer. And this is an exercise which you're not doing, I don't think, but should do. If you calculate, if you did the exercise of calculating this thing for a polarized head, the total rate is the same, but the differential rate before you act, remember we got this by integrating over all possible directions. In the center of mass frame, the kinematics is that the electron, the Z sits there, and then you know, poof, you've got a fermion and an antifermion, and in the center of mass frame, momentum conservation forces them in opposite directions because there's no momentum to start off with. And then their energy is fixed because the energies have to add up to the Z mass. But the direction in which the fermion comes out is completely free. So that the two variables we had to integrate over to get this rate were the solid angle directions of the fermion. Like, so that we had a theta and a phi, which were integrated over 4 pi solid angle to get this result. And when we did the unpolarized thing, which I did in class last time, the answer didn't depend on those angles at all, because the whole process is rotation invariant. It's going to be equally likely to determine it to go in any direction if you don't have a direction in your problem to start off with. But if your Z is polarized, then there is a preferred direction, the direction of the polarization. So you should expect that the distribution of these fermions to depend on the angle between the polarization direction of the Z. So let's say the Z is polarized in that direction. So it's a polarization vector. Then that's an angle which you can expect to be in the answer, and it is. So if you calculate the polarized decay rate, you get a more interesting differential rate. So the differential rate turns out to be, I want to give you the formula because I want to say something about the answer, and it also gives you something to aim at if you calculate it. So it's got all this crap that's in front of this thing anyway. There's a... So all the stuff on dimension has to be here. And the threshold factor. The thing that changes is this angular part. So you have a vector squared 1 minus cos squared theta. So it has, the main point is that it does depend on this angle. This angle is this angle. So if it's a linearly polarized Z, and I ask for the angle between that and the outgoing fermion, if you integrate this respect to theta, you get the previous answer. But it's instructive to take this the small mass limit of this answer. So if we take mf to be much less than nz, which is really true in practice, then most of the stuff goes away, and you get gamma and theta becomes this step up front. The square root goes away. And we have the factors. So the only thing that survives is this term and this term. So we get gb squared. And there's actually, so that says that this factor goes to zero if theta goes to zero or phi. And there's a good reason for that. So that the, and it's worth understanding these qualitative features of decay rates like this, because as you'll see when you do these calculations, the calculations become a mess at some point. And it's useful, you want to have different limits of the calculation that you can know how they're supposed to behave. So you can trust that you've got the right answer by checking that the answer has these behaviors. And one of the arguments, and typically what you're, the way you know various limits, or there's a, I'm about to give you an argument as to why this thing has to vanish from this limit. And it's to do with the competition of two conservation rules. And those are typically the kinds of arguments that are very generic, which are the ones that, you know, the answer doesn't have to satisfy. So the question, so the, I'm looking for an argument as to why should this vanish if theta goes to 0 and pi. So 0 and pi correspond to, you know, if I think the polarization in this direction, then either the fermion went out that way or it went out that way. So it's either the same direction as the polarization or the opposite direction. It doesn't like to come out that way, is what that's saying. And it has to be something to do with polarization, because it, you know, the angular fence is only there because we look at polarized sets. So think about the angular momentum of Z. So the angular momentum what was it allowed to have? It had felicity plus or minus 1 or 0. And in terms of these polarization vectors, remember, if an angular momentum, so it's labeled by J and sigma, if you like, right? J is 1 for Z boson, sigma is equal to 0 or plus or minus 1. If sigma were 1 or minus 1, that corresponds to a polarization vector, which is 1 plus I with 1 plus I. Over 2, 1, I, plus or minus I, 0. And sigma equals 0 corresponds to 0, 0, 1. If the If I'm choosing to measure here the component of angular momentum in the z direction, so this is x, y, z. So what that says is that if our polarization is in this direction, let's make that the z direction. So the angular momentum in this direction is 0 if we've chosen polarization in that direction. So if we measure, if we choose coordinates, so the initial polarization is the z-axis, then sigma is equal to 0, according to what I said there, initially. So that says that because angular momentum is conserved, the fermion and antifermion have to be in a sigma equals 0 configuration. So I'm going to now make an argument as to why, in the limit of the mass of the fermion is 0, the fermions are in a spin-1 configuration if they come out that way. But only in the limit of the mass of 0, because if the mass is non-zero, this is the answer, and this answer does not vanish when theta is equal to 0 pi. So whatever the argument is that makes it want to vanish when it's 0 pi, it has to only be an argument which works when the fermion was massless. And that's the hint that tells you that for massless fermions, we should be talking about felicity rather than angular momentum. And so what I want to do is ask what the helicity is of the final fermions if they had been massless. Ask what that would have meant for the angular momentum in the z direction, and show you that it means that they would have had plus or minus 1 angular momentum. And so the thing that's going to make this thing more advantage is the interplay between conservation of angular momentum and conservation of helicity. And the conservation of helicity is not really exact. It's only approximate conservation if the fermion mass had been 0. So how does that argument go? Well, you remember the interaction that gave us this rate schematically was along the lines of Z fermion bar gamma mu gamma left fermion with G axial, or G left, G Wright, Chairman Barr. Right. And this has the property that that if these fermions are massless, and so that the states that they're creating and destroying are labeled by Felicity, that this thing, if F destroys, so this is the left-handed, this is the form F left bar, complex conjugate, the matrices in between. This is F right, complex conjugate, matrices in between, F right. So this is destroying a left-handed particle and creating a left-handed antiparticle. And this is destroying a right-handed particle and creating a right-handed antiparticle. Did I say that right? I did it exactly wrong. So if F left, remember this is sum over, this is integral d3k of a destruction operator, case of k of given velocity, with coefficients. And then there's an antiparticle creation operator. Now if this thing is left-handed, so let's say this is left-handed. Thing is being destroyed. Now, what is Felicity? Felicity is the eigenvalue of the angular momentum dotted into the momentum direction. So it's the momentum divided by the magnitude of the momentum. This thing is the way to think about what the handedness of the antiparticle is to think that it's the antiparticle is always there, and the fact that the antiparticle is always there is what it makes CPT conserved. So the simple way to think about CPT, about the properties, is that what would CPT do to this thing? And that'll be what the quantum numbers of this thing are. And so if you ask what does parity do, parity changes the sign of momentum. But J is in position cross momentum. So it doesn't change the sign of that because there's two of them. Time reversal changes the sign of momentum but not R. So time reversal also changes the sign of momentum, but it also changes the sign of J. So time reversal doesn't change H. So the bottom line is that the CPT changes the sign of H. So if this destroys the left-handed particle, this creates a right-handed particle, antiparticle. So this destroys the left-handed F. This creates a right-handed F bar. This destroys a right-handed F. That creates a left-handed F bar. And the fact that the handednesses are different is because the particle and the antiparticle quantum numbers are different by CP and T. And the fourth one was P, because that was the one which made this to me stuff. So what does that mean? If I have a left-handed particle and a right-handed antiparticle here, then here's the left hand, here's the right hand. What does handedness mean? If left hand means if that's my momentum, then the spin is in where my fingers are going. And if it's right-handed, it means that that's my momentum, and so on. So if they're both going the same way, the spin is oppositely if it's right-handed from left-handed. So if it's left-handed and right-handed, it's like that, and their spin is in the same direction. So this configuration has an angular momentum a half and a half, and they're adding to each other because the spin is in the same direction. Whereas if they'd both been left-handed, it would have been my left hand, my other left hand, and they would have canceled because this one's going that way and this one's going that way. So the bottom line is that configuration, the angular momentum in that direction is sigma equals plus or minus 1, depending on which direction the left-handed guy went out. And so if Felicity is conserved, which it is if the fermion is massless, we know for sure that the angular momentum in the direction of the motion of the fermions is plus or minus 1. But we know that the initial state had angular momentum 0 in that same direction. If the fermion is coming out in the direction along or opposite to the direction of polarization. So since that's impossible, that would have involved violating angular momentum conservation. The amplitude has to be 0. And that's why the amplitude vanished. If you come off in some other direction, then there's some amplitude that even though this is Felicity, angular momentum plus or minus 1 in that direction, it has an amplitude to be angular momentum 0 in that direction, so the rate can go. And it goes with a factor which is essentially sine theta. And that's why the amplitude is going like sine squared theta. Once it goes, the left and rights are equal amplitude. You know, this is just dv squared plus ga squared is the same thing as g left squared plus g right squared. And that just says that these things the rates add, because they're distinguishable final states, and you have to add the rates rather than their amplitudes. And if the mass is non-zero, even if they come out, the same direction, then velocity is no longer conserved. And that means the amplitude that survives and is non-zero has to be proportional to the mass, and so the rate is proportional to mass squared. And that's why all the things that are not vanishing when theta is equal to pi or zero involve m squared. So you can really estimate the size of the amplitude when zero is when the angle is zero or pi, and you can estimate the coupling constant dependence just by using these simple counting arguments of and following the approximately conserved and conserved quantum numbers through the process. You had your hand up at the point in the middle of that.
No, you don't want to.
Okay. This is a classic PhD prelim question, because the question that is the famous question that is asked every second prelim is, it turns out that the pi plus decays into a mu plus and antineutrino. And sometimes it decays into an electron plus and then neutrino. And you would have thought, so this is, you know, you've got a pion, some complicated wave function, but it's basically a quark and an antiquark. And there's a process whereby it emits a W boson, and then that produces a muon and a neutrino. And if you made this into an electron, you know, nothing cares. Some of all the coupling constants are the same, because the coupling constants of the muon and the electron, the W particle, are exactly the same. So your intuition should have been the rate for these two things are basically the same. The only difference is their mass, and the mass of this thing is 130 MeV. The mass of this thing is about 105 MeV. The mass of this thing is, you know, 0.5 MeV. So they'll be different, but the amount of difference should have been to do with the phase space. And the phase space is not so amazingly smaller here than here. You expect this to be a smaller rate because there's less phase space to go into, because there's less energy available to decay. But you wouldn't expect this to be 10 to the minus 2 of this. You'd expect it to be, you know, maybe 10th of this or something like that. But if you look at the particle data book, this is the decay rate, you know, 99 point something to the time. And so then there's a question is, why is that true? Given it seems like it's a no-brainer that this standard model should be giving you things that where this is smaller than this, rather than this being the biggest thing. This is the one that wins always. And so the prelim question is, why is that true? And the answer is, it's the same kind of an argument. If you have a pion decaying, it's got spin zero. So it's spin zero. And then afterwards, you've got a muon, or an electron, and a neutrino. The neutrino is always left-handed. So let's, in this case, it's not an antineutrino. That's a mu plus. It's a conservation left number says that that's a mu, that's an antineutrino, that's the neutrino. So neutrinos are always left-handed, to the extent we can neglect the neutrino mass, and we can always neglect the neutrino mass that is coming from the ISS. This guy's left-handed. The same kind of vertex argument goes on here. It's, again, morally in this kind of form. It's a fermion, a different kind of fermion, but it's always left with left or right with right. So if that's left-handed, this mu plus is always right-handed. And so this combination, if velocity is conserved, has velocity plus or minus 1, but the same argument we gave over there. And so this decay cannot go at all, regardless of the direction, because this is spin zero. It's not just the component of the spin now, it's the whole spin is wrong. This decay can't happen if this fermion is massless. And so that says that the rate of this decay has to be proportional to this mass squared. So what you should be really thinking from this velocity argument is that the amplitude for the rate pi goes to mu nu is something involving something proportional to n mu. And this amplitude for pi goes to e nu is something proportional to me. And so the ratio of the rate for pi goes to mu nu to pi goes to e nu is going to be, the amplitudes are going to have a ratio which is mu squared over mu squared. And then there'll be some phase-based stuff, which will be the thing that we'll actually make the new one be a little bit smaller. But this ratio is huge, right? This is 100 divided by 0.5 squared. And so that's why, and if you actually numerically put it in here, that actually captures the difference of these rates very accurately. So these velocity arguments are really, they can make the difference between a qualitative understanding of how big these rates are and how they cannot work at all. And the fact that you know all these vertices tells you an enormous amount of the relative size of all these various processes. And if you go through the particle data book, you should be able to make yourself happy with the qualitative size of everything. Because all these conservation rules, they work like a charm in the standard model. And you get it really right in detail. if you have any way of calculating things perturbably at all. Any questions about that felicity argument is a powerful argument. So then the next thing you do after you've done one calculation is that you don't do another calculation until you've actually milked the first one for all it's worth. And so having done Z goes to two fermions, we can do W's go to two fermions, and we do photons. The photons are worth two fermions, what do you get? The W's are for free. So we ask, what's the... This is what your first assignment question is. You won't go to two fermions, the same fermion is going to be the F1, F2, R. And that's because the Lagrangian for the Z fermion has a form of some constant, which I won't write now. That U, R, mu, G left, and the left, G right, gamma right, F. And it's the same F in both cases. Whereas the W fermion term was I E over sine theta. I want to say root 2, but come back to that. Now here we're destroying a W minus, so we have to be destroying a negatively charged electron. So the electron will be here, the neutrino will be here. This had to be gamma left, because that's all we have. The plus complex conjugate somewhere, and it'll be the W star thing. And then if we had, so this is the up quote, this is the down print thing, so if we had a quark, we would have had the matrix V and then up type and mu gamma left down type N. And what I'm not sure if it's a V or V star here. It should be up on the left is for V, so that's right. And the root 2, I'm not sure what it is. And it's 2 root 2. No, it's root 2. That's right. I got the sign wrong. No, it's okay. The Hamiltonian is the sign. Yeah. That was great. All right. So if you're doing the calculation now of W goes to two fermions, fermion antifermion, it's exactly the same algebra you did for Z goes to two fermions with two main changes. First change is, you know, the coupling constants are not exactly the same. So you kind of read through here, where you had a G left, where you had a G right, you have to replace it by a V or a 1. And the E over sine theta becomes E over sine theta 2. But the more important one is that the kinematics, in this case, in the case of a massive fermion, the one thing we knew was that both these fermions are the same mass. The only one mass appears here, whereas both these fermions get different masses here, so the kinematics is a little bit different. That's the one thing you're doing differently in the assignment than that I did on the board last time. I want you to follow the masses of these. I think, actually, maybe I asked you to just do the masses. In the massless case, you can just lift verbatim. Take the massless limit here. I plug in the corresponding GV and G axial for those two couplings here, replace MZ by MW, and replace E over sine cos by E over sine root 2. Then you have the rate for the massless decay. W goes to fermions where you're reflecting the mass of all the fermions. If you keep the masses, it's a little bit more complicated, but not much more. And let me not write it. It's in the notes. Let me just write the masses one, which you can get the lifting from this one. So by transcription, of the Z goes to FFR rate when fermion masses are much less than the Z mass. You can read off the rate. And this is a good thing. This is, you shouldn't think of this being a weakness to transcribe things. This is a strength to transcribe things. So it's EW, so it's E squared. Squared over 2 sine squared theta W 6.5, so that comes in at 12.5. Number of colors. Mass of W bosons, because that's the energy that is available. And there's a V here, so it's a UMN squared, where UMN is equal to 1 if F1, F2 are leptons. And the VMN works. And now you know that I'm lying to you a little bit, because you know that this is what the standard model says, the way I derived it, where the neutrino masses were all zero. And that's what allowed us to always put this, have no matrix here. If there had been a neutrino mass, which there is experimentally, there's another matrix here, which was called the WMN. So then I should really have WMN here. But experimentally, we know these W's are very close to 1. So that's why I'm going ahead and writing the answer that I had before. So this tells you, again, the same kinds of things. So if you, this tells you the total rate for this thing is going to be the same. You know, the mass of the W is 8 GeV, the mass of the Z is 90 GeV. So this thing is going to be in the few GeV-ish range. So its lifetime is going to be in the 10 to the minus 25 second range. All the things that we set for the Zs are going to apply to Ws. This is much smaller than Nw because of the small factors up front again, same reason. The fractions of times the W decays into various things is controlled. That in the ratio of this divided by W to everything, the W mass drops, and these couplings drop, and you're only left with this N and these U's. And in particular, to the extent there's no matrix in front of the leptons are a pure prediction. They have to be equal for all the fermions, to the extent that the masses are negligible. So there's a lot of, that's part of where the statement comes from, that these things are going to be very close to 1. It also says that the same thing is not true for the quarks. The ratios for the quarks are controlled by the ratios and values of these Vs. And that's part of where you could measure, it's not necessarily where they were measured, but that's where you can measure the elements of these Vs just by looking at the relative fraction of time that W goes to pairs of quarks, if you can identify the quarks. The tricky part there is identifying the quarks. So I probably shouldn't flog that too much. The kinematics is different. If the mass is a non-zero, the kinematics is different. It's a two-body decays, it's always true that in the rest frame of the thing decaying, the momenta are back-to-back. It's the P of the fermion 1, P of the fermion 2. And their energies are therefore dictated, so that you'll get a specific energy for both kinds of particles if they're coming from a two-body decay in the rest frame of the W mass. But they won't be the W mass over 2 in this case, because the masses of these two things are not equal to each other. So given that the momenta are equal, you can figure out what their energies are. So the energy, the important thing is that it's a discrete value. So we're roaring through bosons. And before I finish, I'm going to do the Higgs, because there's two things that are new in the Higgs that are worth seeing. So any questions about this so far? It says all I've done is just transcribe the said thing for W's. And again, the message that I didn't really labor too much is that it really works well. If you look at what W's do, you can produce these things. E plus E minus goes to W plus W minus and W decay. And it really is true that the properties that you see are well described by what you measure here. W mass in the standard model is a prediction from the, if you know what E is, you know what sine theta W is, and you know what MZ is, then you know what, you can predict what MW is, and that works very well. So there's a lot of things that are working really well. And the statement that you really understand the gauge couplings of the standard model is the statement that all these things that are appearing in these vertices are very well probed, and they're described very well by a simple couplings like this, and extremely well described by the corrections of these couplings. Okay. All right, so now let's look at the Higgs. So we got this is the scalar particle. H goes to what? Well, how do we decide? It's the same story that we're interested in an S matrix, where we have H goes to anything. And then in perturbation theory, this is 1 minus I integral tau of B tau. So as long as we choose anything not to be Higgs, then we lose the one term. And then the first thing we ask is, what we're expecting to be true is that the decays will be dominated by whatever the first thing is here, to the extent that the second thing is smaller, and that's the justification. Using perturbation theory assumes that these Vs are small. In the standard model, they tend to be small because they're being compressed by small numbers like E or 4 pi. So what we want to do is go through the standard model interactions and ask, who's linear in H? So it destroys the H, it doesn't produce another one, but involves other things. And so there's several kinds of those things. Remember, the Higgs always appeared wherever a mass was. You always had mass. Because the mass was coming from the excitation by the Higgs, you always had a mass term which had the form of, so the fermion masses would be something like minus m fermion over v. Well, this was right this way. It was the Kao coupling to the fermion times V plus the Higgs. Fermion bar fermion. And so if I trade this for the mass, then that's another way of writing this was minus M fermion. I pull the V out. So it's that combination is M fermion. 1 plus H for V. So we know the coupling constant of the Higgs to the fermion is given by the mass of the corresponding fermion, because that's what's telling us the value of this particular problem. So one thing that could appear here can include MF bar pairs, like for Z particles. Same happens in both cases because we never had two different fermions mixing. But that's not the only thing that had a mass. The W's and Z's have masses that way too. So we can came from, we had a derivative of Higgs, dagger derivative of Higgs. When we wrote this out, the covariant derivatives here had things like it was d phi minus I gauge field phi dagger d phi gauge field phi. And the mass terms came from looking at this with this. And so the thing that had to give you the mass was quadratic in that Higgs. So the mass term, if you write it in a mass basis, was minus mw squared 1 plus Higgs over v squared w squared mu w mu. And then there was minus 1 half and z squared 1 plus Higgs over v squared z mu. For the same argument as you got the combination 1 plus Higgs cubed linearly, you get it quadratically here. So in particular, there's a piece here which is linear in H, if we expand this out, and the thing that we're interested in will be there's a minus 2 H and W squared over V. W squared over W. Minus Z squared over V. So that means that this could also state could include ZZ pairs or W plus W minus pairs. And the coupling for each of them is always the mass that's involved. So it's always proportional to the mass involved. It's the mass squared here because a trilinear boson coupling has a coefficient which is detrimental to the mass. So that's why you have a quadratic mass. There's always a factor of the mass involved divided by V. And that tells you that several things. It says that the Higgs is going to want to decay into the heaviest thing it can because that's the coupling that's largest. And so what you get will depend on what the mass of the Higgs is. So if the Higgs is if the mass of the Higgs is less than twice the mass of the W, so that twice the mass of W is about 160 GeV. So that's less than the top mass. And that means that the heaviest thing into which the Higgs can then decay of this list is the heaviest fermion except the top quark, which is the V quark. And V bar has the largest K rate. And without doing the calculation, we have some expectation that the rate, say, for the Higgs to go to dB bar divided by the rate for the Higgs to go to charm bar should be something like the mass of the B quark divided by the mass of the charm quark squared, or something like that. Because the amplitude is equal to the mass of the rate keeps the square. So this ignores phase factors, because this has been reproduced some sort of a meson, and that was some sort of meson, and you have to ask how you actually do those calculations properly, but you're expecting that how much more will this be larger? It'll be larger by something like this ratio. And remember, the B-quark mass is something like 5 GeV, and the charm quark mass is something like 1 GeV. So this ratio is like 25. What do you expect? So you're expecting it to go into quarks before it goes into leptons. But if it's heavier than the W boson, then it can go into W pairs, and the W boson is much heavier than the B quark is, and so there you expect that the rate, the branching ratio in the W bosons will become the largest. Of course, the W's will then decay to other things, so what you'll really see is Higgs goes into things like the E plus E minus and missing energy from the neutrinos that the W's produce. But it's through this process. Since MW is 80 GeV. And once it's above the Z mass, then Z's walls appear. And so the last thing, which I should probably not start now, which my watch disagrees with the wall. What time do you guys have? Okay, so you have 9 hours to do, so the wall will work fast. Let me just actually say the result here, because it's not a big deal. It depends on whether you want to see me calculate it in front of your eyes, or you want to... Let me calculate it. I'll do it next time. I'll calculate it. Because the message I forgot to tell you is that class is canceled next week. I'm not here next week. So that'll happen twice this term. Next week, and then 2 weeks from next week. So given that, let me just write what the answer would be. It's the one that's most interesting is the one in the gauge bosons, because there's a point we made there. So let me just sketch out for you what the steps are. And it's exactly the same algebra that I did before. It's actually less complicated than it was for the Zeds, because there's fewer gamma matrices running around in these interactions. So it's actually an easier one to calculate than the W one that you got before with. And I encourage you to do it, particularly the W one. The W calculation is explicitly in the notes, whereas the Higgs one, I think the answer is quoted. So for the amplitude for Higgs goes to W plus W minus, it's you're looking for a W plus W minus. The thing that was appearing here was here, right? So it's so you evaluate this in the same way as before. The Higgs is an integral p3 k cosine cubed square root of twice tan d. And there's a second question for W mu in terms of the creation operator and the anti-creation operator, anti-part of the creation operator, and a polarization vector. You just plug those things in here, you read off what the creation relation operator is doing in the Fisher's element, and you get the amplitude, you square that amplitude, and you plug it into the formula for the rate. So there's nothing deep. And what you find is that the sum over, so 1/3 sum over all spins. So what I'm doing here now is I'm going to, sorry, I lied. There's no initial spin, there's only final spins, I'm going to sum over the final spins. That's going to involve a sum over the spins of the Kuppmann quadratic and these polarization vectors, because I'll have one for each of these two things. I'm going to square it. And you remember that we had an expression for what sum over spin of epsilon mu, epsilon star nu, was eta mu nu plus p nu over m w squared, where p was the momentum in this polarization vector. So using expressions like that, you can evaluate this spin sum in the rate squared. So the sum of the square, sum over the spin summed rate, so I'm summing over the final spins, turns out to be, when you use a trick like that, it's got this factor of the coefficient of the coupling constant up front squared. And then the rest of this turns out to be 2 plus p dot q squared over mw squared, and then mw fourth, where p and q are the momenta of the two w's. So this is the momentum p and the momentum q. That's the main piece of algebra. And so if you use that as the decay rate, then what you find is the differential rate becomes total rate. It's m Higgs and m Higgs squared over, how this dividing factor to so it's m Higgs, we're expecting the answer to go like m Higgs, because that's the energy available in decay. We're expecting to be at 1 over 4 pi factor, because that's 16 pi. We're expecting a coupling constant squared, Higgs over v squared. I'll come back to that. Then squaring out that square bracket gives you things like minus 1 minus 4 and w squared over n Higgs squared. Let's plural w squared over n Higgs squared. And then there's a phase space factor that turns off the decay when the W mass is half the Higgs mass. So the reason I wanted to show this is that first imagine that let's imagine that the Higgs is very, very this term, this has got a finite limit. Why does it have a finite limit? What I was telling you over here for the fermions is that the coupling of the fermions is proportional to the mass of the fermion. So the decay rate in the fermions was proportional to the mass of the fermion squared, and I told you that the whole answer is going to go like the fermion, the thing that you're hanging into squared. Then I told you that the W bosons and the Z bosons are coupling proportional to their mass squared. And so you would have thought that if I calculated the rate for Higgs goes to W, plus or minus, the whole thing should report to the MW over V squared. And what I got, there's terms like that. If I multiply that one times this one, there's an overall factor of MW over, actually, it's this one I want to tell me. This one gives you an MW squared over over V squared. But there's other things going on. And in particular, if MW goes to zero, this does not turn off. If MW went to zero, over m Higgs, I lose that term, I lose that term, but then this thing just sits there. So the answer would become this. And that sounds like it's weird, because it sounds like I've told you that the coupling of the W to the Higgs is before the W mass. I turn that mass off, and the answer is still not zero. What happened there? What happened there was the Higgs mechanism. Remember, the W boson has a velocity 0 and plus or minus 1. And this coupling came about because of the coupling of the W boson to the Higgs field. And that W, the thing that's appearing here is the massless gauge field. That's the velocity plus or minus 1. The velocity 0 thing that W boson, that came about, that was actually really started its life as being part of the Higgs doublet. The Higgs doublet, remember, we chose a gauge where we made all the various parts of the Higgs doublet 0, except for the physical one. And that's what gave us the longitudinal part of the gauge field. But it's, so the thing that starts off, ends up being the longitudinal mode of the spin 1 particle, comes from the scalar multiplet. And so the process whereby a Higgs decays into a velocity 0 W boson, you can think of it in the standard model as being something which is a Higgs process which doesn't involve W's at all. It's something which is controlled by the scalar potential. The scalar potential, remember, was lambda probably divided by 4 pi dagger phi minus b squared over 2 squared or something like that. And so there's couplings in here between all the various modes of the Higgs. But in particular, the strength of that coupling is controlled by lambda. But you remember lambda, if I expand this out to look at the quadratic piece, lambda is proportional to the Higgs mass divided by b, in the same way that the other couplings were proportional to their mass divided by b. And so what this thing that's surviving here is an artifact of a piece of the answer which is going like lambda. And it's going like lambda because the theory remembers the longitudinal mode of the W came from the Higgs sector. And so if I want to turn off the W mass, I can do that by turning off the gauge coupling here. If I take the gauge coupling to go to zero, then that kills this term without killing these terms. And if I did that, that's a limit where lambda didn't have to go to zero, so I still get a rate for the Higgs to the K. If I made the whole answer zero by making V go to infinity or something, which would have turned off both these terms, then I would get an answer which goes to zero. That's what this V here says. But if I want to turn this off and not turn this off, I'm taking the limit where G goes to zero and lambda doesn't go to zero. And so there is still a process whereby the longitudinal part of the W interacts with Higgs, and that's what the rate tells you. So there's a surprise in the Higgs in the W and the Z couplings, which is that you should remember that part of those things came from the scalar fields, and so that part of the, if you're thinking about the strength of couplings of W and Z purely in terms of the gauge couplings, you can be deceived for specifically processes which involve the velocity zero components of the W's, which really came into you originally as scalar fields. And so whose interactions are controlled by terms down here which don't involve gauge. Questions? That was a good place to talk about. That's chapter 4 in the deck. So I guess next time I see you guys, please.
So, you need to do a final